Side Door, a podcast from the Smithsonian with support from PRX. I'm Lizzie Peabody. It's the early 1800s. You're watching the sunset on the largest city in the world, Edo, Japan, known today as Tokyo. The sun has just dropped beneath the horizon in the distance, and the last bit of light drains from the orange sky. You light a candle. A breeze comes through the window, catching a spark off your flame, which lands on the paper wall beside you. A black singe mark blooms into an orange circle, picking up speed as it gets larger, 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 and then erupts into flames. The fire begins licking upwards at the wooden beams crossing the ceiling. It spreads to the next wall. Gray smoke fills the air just above your head and churns into angry black swirls. You struggle to breathe. You run to the window and scream for help. In the distance, you can hear a bell ringing. And down the road, a throng of men approach on foot.
They would have pulled up in a gang. That would have been this very intimidating group.
It's the Fire Brigade. And this is Kit Brooks, curator at the Smithsonian's National Museum of Asian Art. Kit says some of these firefighters would have worn heavy jackets soaked in water, but others would have been nearly naked, wearing only loincloths and tattoos. But not just any tattoos, dragon tattoos.
In East Asia, dragons live in the sky, and they bring storms and are creatures of the water. So the idea of adorning yourself physically with dragon tattoos is a way of this talismanic protective function.
You watch this horde of brawny tattooed men approach. At the head of the group is the fire chief. And in a city of wood and paper, the fire chief is like a god, arguably even more powerful in this moment. He yells to his men to get to work, but they don't use water to put out the fire.
Even the idea of putting out fires didn't exist. The way that you combated fire is to destroy the buildings surrounding the fire. So to clear a space of land so that the burning debris and the ashes couldn't light something else on fire.
The firefighters run up ladders to the roofs of your neighbors' homes. They start tearing off the tiles and throwing them to the ground. Others wield long sticks with metal hooks at the end, which they use to grab at the facade and tear the walls down. Neighbors gather, staring at the flames and the acrobatics of the firefighters. But then the crowd begins to part, and you see the banner of another fire brigade snaking its way closer. The first fire chief turns and yells, "This is our turf!" "In your dreams," the other fire chief screams back. And then the chiefs are nose to nose. In the commotion, someone pushes someone else. Then there's a punch. The men fighting the fire drop their tools and run to support their chief, and an all-out brawl breaks out. The flames grow unchecked and take hold of your neighbor's partially disassembled homes. The entire block is now inflamed as the firefighters, many of them clearly drunk, brawl in the street. Your home is gone for good, which, unfortunately, was not uncommon at this time. Kit Brooks says there was even a popular saying in Edo, Japan.
Edo no hana wa kajito kenka. So the flowers of Edo are fires and fights. So they spring up like flowers. So these fires would pop up like this, and also fights would as well. And there was this idea that firefighters were almost as dangerous as the fires they're trying to put out.
Firefighters held a unique position in Edo, Japan. Not quite hero, not quite villain. Feared, but loved. And this ambivalence is front and center in a new exhibition at the Smithsonian's National Museum of Asian Art. It's called Anti-Heroes and Underdogs, and it includes ink prints that depict scenes just like this one.
When you look at this image, you can see, you know, the under the light of the moon, but everything is, you know, lit up by this, you know, inferno, this incredible amount of smoke and flames. The building is almost melting. as it's just burning down with the intensity of this fire. But you can see just the amount of firefighters involved in firefighting.
The exhibition is full of old prints that tell a story, almost like a graphic novel. You can see the action unfold in the images. Scene by scene, stories unfold. And one of these stories shows a real-life event. It's the story of another brawl, one which solidified the firefighters as the ultimate underdogs.
A group of drunken firefighters started a fight with two sumo wrestlers.
The fight that followed was so legendary, it has been reproduced in artwork, writing, and even a kabuki play. So this time on Side Door, we bring you the story of the May Brigade riot, when a group of drunken firefighters took on the only people in Japan quite possibly tougher than they were, sumo wrestlers. And it ended in a winner-take-all death match. So who won and who lost? Who is the hero and who's the villain? It might just depend on who tells the story and when. And we're telling you that story right now. Well, after the break.
This episode is brought to you by Progressive. Most of you aren't just listening right now. You're driving, cleaning, and even exercising. But what if you could be saving money by switching to Progressive? Drivers who save by switching save nearly $750 on average, and auto customers qualify for an average of 7 discounts. Multitask right now. Quote today at Progressive.com. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. National average 12-month savings of $744 by new customers surveyed who saved with Progressive between June 2022 and May 2023. Potential savings will vary. Discounts not available in all states and situations.
1805, Edo, Japan. It's a brisk spring afternoon. Three firemen from the May Fire Brigade are walking down the street, joking, laughing, and they see that a sumo wrestling tournament is underway in the Shinmei Shrine. And they say, let's check it out.
Three firemen try to walk into the match, into the side, without paying. You know, that rubbed the sumo wrestlers the wrong way.
This is Frank Feltens, a curator at the Smithsonian's National Museum of Asian Art. He says it's also highly likely that these firemen were a little bit drunk at the time.
I wonder if they were ever really fully sober, especially when they're with their friends.
So the firefighters wander in off the street and expect the sumo wrestlers to pause and acknowledge them, sort of pay tribute to the firefighters who rule this neighborhood. But the sumo wrestlers are not so pleased that these firefighters just wandered in like they own the place. This is a shrine. It existed on a plane above and beyond the common streets of the firefighters' domain.
Fire brigades at the time had policing power over their district within the city. But sumo wrestlers had policing power or, you know, authoritative power over shrine precincts.
Like firefighters, sumo wrestlers held a unique place in Edo, Japan. Only a select few children were chosen to become sumo wrestlers, and they were plucked from society at an early age and put into training. It was like being selected by God to play for his football team.
Sumo originated sort of as an entertainment for spirits and deities in shrines.
It originated as entertainment for, like, an invisible audience?
Exactly, exactly. So as part of the rituals performed at shrines, and then, you know, gradually morphed into this as a public spectacle, a public sport.
Sumo wrestlers were like professional athletes, celebrities, and religious leaders rolled into one. They were elite members of society.
In the Edo period, sumo wrestlers were always associated or kept, as it were. They were the, you know, the kind of a pseudo-property of feudal lords. They were permitted to wear a sword, which, you know, only samurai were allowed to wear swords. So they kind of operated in this pseudo-samurai environment. And I think people did think of them as being, you know, quite stuck up.
So back at the shrine, there's this sort of standoff. The firefighters are like, hey, you're on our turf. Come say hi. And the sumo wrestlers are like, no, this is our turf. You can't barge in like this. We're not coming to say anything.
That rubbed both of them the wrong way, that they were not greeted and that they weren't, that their sort of authority was not acknowledged by either party. So I think that was the biggest slide of it all, that there was sort of this clash of classes.
Whoever was at fault, this interaction is what led to the May Brigade riot in real life. But if you were to see the Kabuki theater version of these events that premiered 85 years later, you'd get a completely different picture.
So it begins with an episode that is actually, by all accounts, not part of the original story.
The Kabuki theater production opens on some sumo wrestlers who are having a party in a fancy tea house in Edo. And they're getting kind of loud, a little bit rambunctious.
But the firefighters are having a party in the room next to it.
In the play, the May Brigade fire chief, Tatsugoro, goes over to the rowdy sumo wrestlers and he asks them if they wouldn't mind keeping the noise down. A real-life fire chief probably would have had some choice words and maybe even a punch to throw their way. But that's not how Tatsugoro reacts in the play.
Tatsugoro walks over and says, you know, what's going on here? And the sumo wrestlers treat him in a very condescending way. So he is very much, you know, flummoxed by that.
Insulted.
Insulted, very much.
Tatsugoro tries to be nice to the sumo wrestlers, and they insult him, call him names. Still, he's deferential, and ultimately, he walks away, turning the other cheek, so to speak. There's not a lot of ambiguity in this version of the story. The sumo wrestlers are clearly being jerks. They're not nice guys to the extremely reasonable Tatsugoro, who just wants to have a nice time at the tea house. So if you're in the audience of the Kabuki play, it's clear where your loyalties lie, with the firefighters. And there's a reason why the story is presented this way in 1890, and it has to do with how Japan had changed since the actual events took place 85 years earlier.
The feudal system had collapsed. Japan was no longer isolated from the outside world. It had frequent interaction with the Asian continent, with America, with Europe. The emperor had moved from Kyoto to Tokyo. A constitutional monarchy was established. Japan was an entirely different country.
In the late 19th century, this new Japan was trying to reestablish itself, both to foreigners looking in from afar and to its own people. What did it stand for? What did its society value? Who were its heroes, and what were the stories being told about them? One way to solidify these ideals was through one of Japan's most popular forms of media at the time, Kabuki theater.
Kabuki was a way to spend the day. You wouldn't just go for a performance, but you would go in the morning and stay the entire day and watch a string of performances, eat there, talk. Scenes of the Kabuki theater that you see in pictures from the time are raucous. People are yelling at each other. They yelling at the guy over there selling bowls of rice. Another guy is selling sake. So, I mean, this is basically almost football stadium type of atmosphere.
Wow. Okay. Not how I pictured the theater. Kabuki theater was full of explosions and spectacle. Absolutely stunning special effects for theater at the time. But by the time this play was performed in 1890, Kabuki was becoming less crowd-pleasing and more high-minded. Old heroes were given modern situations. It would be like making a film about the American Wild West with a climate change storyline.
And for that reason, in the late 19th century, around 1890, that period, you see all these newly written Kabuki plays popping up that sort of, talk nostalgically about the good old past, but with a moral spin on the present as well.
So when the sumo wrestlers insult Tatsugoro in the play, he doesn't grab the sumo's sword, hold it to his neck and say, "You want to say that again?" He de-escalates the situation. He goes home to talk about it with his wife.
His wife, Onaka, is saying, "You gotta do something, you gotta fight to defend your honor. Who are you even if you don't fight?"
Oh no! Tatsugoro listens to his wife. He decides that his honor has been insulted and he must defend it. And he also feels compelled to stand up for the common man.
Firefighters were very much, you know, men of the city. They were men of the urban classes. You know, they would have lived on your block. Like, you knew all these people. Compared to sumo wrestlers, it's just a very different kind of presence that they had.
This is Kit Brooks again. Kit says that in the play, Tatsugoro sees no other option. The firefighters have to fight.
they have principles and they stick to them, and that's kind of what makes them admirable, even if you, you know, don't think that they should be abandoning their families for this level of dispute.
Fire Chief Tatsugoro rallies his firefighters for battle. They toast each other with glasses of water, a firefighter tradition.
They exchange these ceremonial cups of water, which is like an agreement that you're parting forever, because there's an understanding that they're going to fight to the death.
Wow. The reluctant Tatsugoro steps up to meet the moment. And in this decision, he becomes a champion of the lower class, the ultimate underdog, standing up to the elitist sumo wrestlers. What happens next? We'll find out after the break. It's the day of the May Brigade riot of 1805, and Fire Chief Tatsugoro is ready for battle with the two sumo wrestlers who have besmirched his honor.
Tatsugoro is drinking at home, and he's, you know, preparing to say farewell to his family, and he hears the bell ringing, which is going to signify the end of the sumo wrestling matches. He rushes to the scene because he knows all his men are gathering there.
In the Kabuki theater version of events, the firefighters are planning an ambush on the sumo wrestlers. The firefighters wait for the crowd to slowly trickle out of the shrine.
Tatsugoro is very keen to make sure we need to wait till everything is finished. We need to wait till all the civilians are out of the arena before we start.
The firefighters ready their weapons for ambush. The sumo wrestlers have no idea what is coming. In the real-life version of these events, it's not clear exactly what happened, but we do know that two famous sumo wrestlers were involved, and they faced roughly 40 to 100 firefighters. And to get a sense of just how two men could do this, you have to understand the sheer mass of a sumo wrestler's body.
It's just a very different kind of presence that they had. You know, they're these, you know, one-man mountains walking down the street.
This is true even today. If I were to see a sumo wrestler on the street, would I be in awe?
You would be. I am. they are tall, broad, and big. I've never, ever seen a sumo wrestler in sweatpants and t-shirt outside, always in perfectly manicured kimonos. Just the way they look, the way they behave, the way, you know, they come with this retinue of people barely by themselves.
If they have like an entourage.
Exactly. So there is a sort of pizzazz all over them, basically.
They're celebrities.
They are celebrities of like the truest kind.
In the Kabuki play, the sumo wrestlers were like the perfect foils for the firefighters. A clash of classes and a contest of who really is the toughest. Firefighters used their muscles for practical purposes, like putting out fires and saving lives. They saw the sumo wrestlers' muscles as being for show, dancing around, flexing for crowds, and looking good. And the firefighters were like, we'll show you what a real tough guy looks like.
They attack the two sumo wrestlers. It's this fight that breaks out between the people using the different kind of equipment that is associated with their professions. So whereas the firefighters are using these Tobaguchi hooks and, you know, trying to smash ladders over people's heads, the sumo wrestlers are fighting with the, you know, the benches that the spectators would have sat on.
This sounds like WrestleMania.
It
or
does,
something.
Yeah. and I think people have compared sumo wrestling to, you know, it's like part sport, it's part religion, it's part theater. And this is definitely that. And this is, you know, one of those, you know, no holds barred, people, you know, smashing chairs over each other.
Firefighters flip into the air and run up ladders without using their hands. It's the sort of acrobatics you might see at Cirque du Soleil.
You also have this famous scene of firefighters jumping up on the roof of the stable and throwing these tiles down at their opponents.
There's running and jumping and punching and grappling. Sumo wrestlers are flipping firefighters in the air, tossing them aside. The firefighters keep coming, leaping and lunging, and then
this official appears and says, "Hold on a minute, everyone. We're gonna bring this in front of the magistrate." And then they all say, "Yes, of course. We're gonna stop fighting immediately." And then the play ends.
What? Yep. This battle royale, like the third act in a big action Marvel movie when all the Avengers are finally attacking. Right at that moment, a pencil-nosed bureaucrat comes in and says, "Hold on, I think we can figure this out in small claims court." And everyone's like, "Okay, cool."
This is really such an anticlimactic moment, and really it tries to show how sort of this newer version of Kabuki theater is trying to be much tamer and also much more
politically correct.
Politically correct, exactly. Trying to nurture these law-abiding citizens. You know, if you have a fight, if you have a problem, go to the authorities. Don't fight it out yourself. And, you know, this is probably the least exciting ending of any Kabuki play I've ever seen, to be honest with you. Let's fight this out in court. Bye.
In real life, the fight played out differently. No official appeared. The riot only stopped after dozens of men were injured and one firefighter was killed. There was no moral, just senseless violence. So it's interesting to see how this story gets tweaked and adapted for the time period in which it's told, a changing Japan with new values. A macho brawl with no clear hero or villain gets turned into a clash of classes with a twist of morality at the end. Kit Brooks says, in real life, the firefighters would not have been the heroes of this story. Even in the play, they're not really the good guys. But they are the characters you root for.
My sympathies lie with the firefighters, so I think probably the way that I interpret this is that, you know, I'm very much on their side.
Why?
I think I would say it as the firefighters are the relatable guys, right? They're the people you can understand.
And that's basically what an anti-hero is. They're not really good, per se, but they're relatable. And who's more relatable out of the firefighters and the sumo wrestlers? The ones who have a few drinks to deal with their demanding job and get a little wild from time to time? Were the perfect, godlike celebrities who never wear sweatpants to the Cheesecake Factory. Frank says that's why he and Kit created this exhibition of anti-heroes and underdogs, because this artwork reveals who people related to in 19th century Japan, both in art and at the theater.
There is an entire genre in Kabuki theater that focuses entirely on people sort of at the fringes of society, people in sort of in the gray areas. So the firefighters fit into that category perfectly because they just embody the underdog, essential to the survival of the city. But at the same time, they were also at the lowest tier of it. So that made for a natural kind of hero.
And while there's no clear winner in the Kabuki theater version of the May Brigade riot, I can tell you who won in real life. Unequivocally, it was a complete blowout on the side.
Wait. Hold on. Winners and losers. I think we're losing sight of what's really important. We should make sure we all go do our taxes in a timely manner.
You know what? What a great idea. Let's do it. Can I deduct this terrarium I bought for all these leeches?
Honestly, I don't think you can deduct that.
You've been listening to Side Door, a podcast from the Smithsonian with support from PRX. To learn more about the Underdogs and Anti-Heroes exhibition at the Smithsonian's National Museum of Asian Art, you can check out our newsletter. We'll share some images from the exhibition, including some paintings of the May Brigade riot. You can subscribe at si.edu/sidedoor. Let us know what you think of the episode or share your own show ideas with us on social media. We're at SideDoorPod on Twitter and Instagram. You can also email us your suggestions or show ideas at sidedoor@si.edu. For help with this episode, we want to thank Frank Feltens and Kit Brooks. Our podcast team is James Morrison, Natalie Boyd, Anne Kinnanen, Caitlin Schaefer, Tammy O'Neill, Jess Sadek, Lara Koch, and Sharon Bryant. Episode artwork is by Dave Leonard. Extra support comes from our colleagues at PRX. Our show is mixed by Tarek Fuda. Our theme song and episode music are by Breakmaster Cylinder. If you want to sponsor our show, please email sponsorship@prx.org. The Smithsonian is celebrating its 176th birthday this year. Wow, we're old. That's nearly two centuries of history, discovery, and knowledge, all thanks to the support of people just like you. Help us celebrate another two centuries by making a gift at si.edu/contribute. You'll also help us keep the lights on here at Side Door. That's si.edu/contribute. We really couldn't do it without you. I'm your host, Lizzie Peabody. Thanks for listening. I love your telling of the ending. I'm picturing this, like, kind of nerdy little guy showing up being like, hey, wait a minute, stop it.
I picture this, the playwright, like, how am I going to make this end? They can't kill each other. I'm just going to make them fight it out in court. It's like, okay.